From Luminary and Built It Productions, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Stephen M. R. Covey, who built on the work of his father, author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
My father taught win-win or no deal. If you go for win-lose, that's in the long run not very sustainable. If I go for lose-win, where, you know, hey, I'm a martyr, everyone steps on me, you know, that's not sustainable either. That's not going to work for me. Lose-lose, everyone loses. But win-win, win-win is really the only sustainable approach.
The legacy of Stephen Covey Sr. and how his son Stephen Covey Jr. continues to amplify it.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Back in the 1980s, Stephen R. Covey anticipated a new kind of leadership, not the table-pounding, charismatic leadership of Jack Welch, but an empathetic kind which prioritized listening, collaboration, and regular introspection and self-improvement. In 1989, he published a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and it was an almost immediate sensation. Today, it's widely considered one of the most influential business books of the 20th century. 7 Habits has sold over 30 million copies worldwide. If you have it, I'd be willing to guess it's one of the few books you regularly reread. But long before the 7 Habits were influencing people around the world, they were influencing Stephen Covey's children, including his oldest son, Stephen Jr., who says he and his 8 siblings were the guinea pigs of the 7 Habits. Stephen Covey, the son, grew up in Provo, Utah. After graduating from college, he spent a few years working as a real estate broker and then as an investment banker. But in his early 30s, he decided to join his father at the Covey Leadership Center, a consulting firm that specialized in corporate training that Covey Sr. had founded in 1980. Stephen Jr. would go on to write his own best-selling books, including The Speed of Trust. But he's also been instrumental in making his father's 7 Habits into a worldwide phenomenon. His father began thinking about those 7 Habits while he was a professor at Brigham Young University, teaching business management and organizational behavior. He'd started a consulting business using some of these theories he was developing about the 7 Habits, and those habits really resonated with his clients. Now, when you first hear them, the 7 Habits, things like begin with the end in mind, or synergize, or think win-win, don't really sound revolutionary. They seem like common sense.
The principles were already out there, but my father made it accessible and usable. He brought them together in a coherent framework with a language and with a way to operationalize it. And I think that was a great metaphor, because that's really what he's done is, again, he doesn't own these principles. He didn't invent the principles. They're out there. They're principles. He organized them. He framed them. He languaged them. He synthesized them. He made them accessible and tangible and practical. And that's really the strength and the power of the 7 Habits, is that they're profound and they're actionable.
Yeah. And what's amazing about the book is, I mean, if you look at the 7 Habits, they're so straightforward and clean and simple. And I want to talk about, I just want to kind of go through them very briefly, because when we read them now, they seem like common sense, but really they are things that people don't often think about. For example, he talks about, you know, the first three are about sort of around this idea of independence, right? And he talks about the idea of being proactive. So what practically was he trying to say there?
Yeah, he was trying to say, you are responsible for your life. You know, you're not a program, you're a programmer. And you can create your future and create your life. And, you know, you're responsible. You're in charge. But in between what happens to us and our response, there is a space. And in that space is your ability to choose your response based upon your values. And so that idea is the foundational habit because it makes all the other habits work. And the whole idea of the first three habits is they take a person from dependence to independence. Hmm. And, you know, that's habit 1, 2, and 3. Be proactive, meaning you're in charge. Begin with the end in mind is habit 2.
That's number 2. Begin with the end in mind. So when you even start a project, you think of what does the end look like?
What does the end look like? Mm-hmm. What are we trying to achieve? What are we trying to accomplish? What's important to me? What are my values? And then the next one, habit 3, put first things first. Hmm. You know, that helps a person become independent, you know, where I'm not dependent upon other people's opinion of me. I'm independent. And the first three habits really help a person achieve that.
Yeah.
They're basic. They're foundational. But the common practice on those same first three habits sometimes is, you know, instead of be proactive, it's kind of, you know, respond to the world around you as it's hitting you, you know, react to it. Instead of begin within the mind, it's kind of go with the flow, you know, whatever happens. And instead of put first things first, it's, you know, do what's easiest first or what's in front of you and what's proximate, pressing, et cetera, versus really scheduling your priorities. Mm-hmm. And so it's basic.
Yeah.
My father called it a private victory.
And so he sort of has these first three, which is independence, right? Gain, create independence, self-mastery. But then he moves on to interdependence, that independence is only one side of the coin. You must embrace interdependence to actually succeed. And that means working with other people. That's how he kind of structures the next three key habits.
Precisely. So once you've achieved independence, you now have choices and options that you don't have if you haven't achieved that. And so the next higher value now, since life is all about people and we get work done with and through people, now is saying, what if we can work well with others? Habit 4 is kind of the mindset. If I got to work with others, my mindset should be mutual benefit.
Yes.
And my father phrased it as think win-win. And he didn't say practice win-win. He didn't say accomplish win-win because you may or may not be able to do it. It's the mindset of thinking win-win. It's an abundance mentality mindset versus a scarcity mentality mindset, you know, where there's enough for everybody. So I want to win, of course, but I want you to win too.
Yep.
And mutual benefit, win-win, is really the only sustainable approach in an interdependent reality. If you go for win-lose, I win, you know, and you lose, that's in the long run not very sustainable.
Yes.
I go for lose-win, where, you know, hey, I'm a martyr, everyone steps on me, you know, you do too. That's not sustainable either. That's not going to work for me. Lose-lose, everyone loses, you know, but win-win. My father taught win-win or no deal. In other words, if we can't both work together, then it's maybe best that we don't collaborate together if we're not going to both win. So that's kind of the root, the foundation of it. And then the route is then seek first to understand, then to be understood. Now, that's the longest expression in the seven habits, but it's really a profound
one.
It's
so profound. It is so profound.
It is. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. And the tendency for most of us is we want to be understood first, especially if we think we're right. You know, it's kind of like I want to go in and say, here's what we need to do. Here's, you know, and give my side. And my father's reversing the order. And he says the key to effectiveness and the key to influence with other people is to first be influenced by them, to first understand them to their satisfaction, because then they become far more open to be influenced by you. When they say, thank you for listening, I feel understood. Mm-hmm. Then they become far more open to saying something like, and tell me about you, what you think. Until they feel understood, they're still fighting for air. They're fighting for survival. They're fighting to be heard. And that's the thing. Most people listen with the intent not to truly understand, but rather most people listen with the intent to reply, to respond.
Yep.
So they're patient. They're even respectful. But in many ways, they're kind of just waiting their turn.
Yep.
But really, what really builds trust, what really builds influence, is when the person feels understood.
Yes.
And that's the power, the magic of that habit. And then your ability to then be understood. Now, there is the second half, which is, yes, I want to be heard and I want to be understood too. But if I start by understanding, my ability to have influence will go up dramatically. And it's kind of a paradox, but it's really powerful.
Yep.
And habit six is now with mutual understanding, we synergize.
Yep.
We try to create synergy means where 1 + 1 = 3 or more. You know, 3, 5, 10, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, where our differences become our strengths to innovate, to create, because we understand each other first and we're trying to achieve win-win. Our mindset is win-win. And so you synergize, you create and you innovate and you invent.
Yeah.
And come up with new alternatives. That's the power of the second three. You know, it's the public victory together.
Yeah. I mean, it is remarkable because he put this book out in 1989 talking about empathy, understanding, and listening. And that was today, you know, a lot of really great, incredible thought leaders and business leaders who clearly are influenced greatly by your father's work, like Simon Sinek and others, really talk about empathy and talk about listening, right, and seeking to understand first. But that was a radical idea in 1989. I mean, business leaders didn't sit around and, listen and try to understand. I mean, we were talking about men like Jack Welch and pounding the table, right? I mean, what was going on at the time this book came out?
Absolutely, it was like you say, Guy. Today, this is kind of hitting the sweet spot of where people have come to, but in 1989, it was seen as radical.
Yeah,
and you know, like, wow, well, you know, seek first to understand. You know, no, I've got to be heard first. You know, and you're bold and you're audacious, and you come out and give the vision. But even today, even though it's talked about today, most people are still not very good at it.
No, it kind of leads to the seventh habit, because I think it's connected to all. It is connected to all the first six, and it's sharpen the saw or grow, right? This idea of continuous, sustainable, long-term improvement. And what I love about this one is it essentially what I think he was saying to his readers was, look, you're going to mess up. You're going to forget these six lessons now and again. You're going to fall off the wagon. You're going to go back to your old habits. But if you remember number seven, you're going to continue to constantly reset.
Absolutely. The seventh habit kind of reinforces the other six and improves them and helps you get better, helps you reset. I like how you express that. And that gives us hope, gives us optimism. And also, so we don't burn out. And you know, just become drained and exhausted. You know, that'd be the opposite of sharpen the saws, you know, just burn yourself out. So this gives you hope and optimism that it's a journey. And we always are falling short, but we're constantly trying to get better. Maybe one of the top questions we get around the seven habits is this. As you look at the seven habits, is there any one of these that's the most important of all the habits? I heard my father be asked that question countless times. You know, Stephen or Dr. Covey, which of the seven habits is the most important one? And honestly, Guy, at different times, I've heard him say any and each of the seven. Uh-huh. One time I heard him say, habit one, because habit one is the foundational habit. You know, be proactive. Without that, you can't do any of the others. I've heard him at other times say, habit two by far, because that's a vision. Without vision, you don't go anywhere. I've heard him say, habit 7, sharpen the saw. You know, back to your point, that renews you and resets you. So at different times, I've heard him say each of the 7. And it's because they're all important. So maybe a way of thinking about it to our listeners is the most important of the 7 habits is the one that maybe each of us is having the hardest time living and applying.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Wow!
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So, Stephen, when this book came out, from what I understand, I mean, or around the time this book came out, you had a career. I mean, you went to Harvard Business School, and you were in investment banking and working as in real estate, and you kind of had, you had this path that you, and I'm sure that, you know, being the son of Stephen Covey, you wanted to forge a path and figure it out on your own. And but I guess at a certain point, you sort of sat down with your dad, and he kind of looked at you and said, look, you know, do you he asked you this question. He said, do you want to spend your life building buildings or building souls, which was an invitation to come and work with him?
Exactly. And it was so interesting because, you know, I was coming out of 2 years at Harvard Business School, getting my MBA, and I had, an opportunity on Wall Street. I have an opportunity in investment banking. I had another opportunity in real estate development where I had been before, and I really liked it. That was building buildings, and that was interesting and very fun. And just if you looked at the, pure logic of it, those were more prestigious. They offered more by traditional measures of success, of prestige and money and everything else. And then also, like you were suggesting, that one was maybe a little bit more my own identity, right? Of, I'm not tied necessarily to my father. But at the same time, as I was coming out and I was deciding what to do, this was just a few months before the 7 Habits book was about to be launched. And I really believed that this book was going to have a profound impact on people, on leaders, on organizations throughout the entire world. That's pretty audacious to think
it
that
is, yeah.
Of any book, right?
Yeah.
But I just really was convinced of it. And so I really believed this is going to take off and it's going to really impact people. And I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And so even though I knew that I'd have a little bit less of an identity because I had the same name as my father, that was more of a risk for me, but I felt like I did want to be a part of something extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, very prescient of you. So you joined your dad's company, Covey Leadership Center, and then you eventually became the CEO for several years. And while you're there, I mean, it just explodes. It becomes this huge leadership development company. Seven Habits becomes like easily one of the most influential books in the English language over the past 50 years, right? But it's interesting to me because you never turned your dad into a like a cult figure, right? I mean he passed away, of course, in 2012. And there are photos of him and his iconic bald head and his big smile. But he was never like a cult guru type, right? And you know, the whole business that was built around him and his book that you helped build never did that. And I really have a lot of admiration for that, I have to say.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you, it's a tribute to my father because here's what was important to him, what he was very clear about. And that is this, that the power was in the principles, not in him. And he never saw himself or wanted to be seen in any way, shape, or form as a guru, but rather he would point people to principles. And if someone would say, gosh, you're so insightful, he said, no, the power's in these principles. And guess what? He'd say, I didn't invent these principles. They are out there. And all I've done is tried to organize and frame in language to make it accessible what's out there, what people have been doing for centuries. And he'd always would point the light to the principles. And these principles are universal. He'd really kind of would push away from anyone that tried to guruize him, if you will.
Yeah.
And I must say this, you'll appreciate this. Someone asked my father, well, do you live the seven habits yourself, Dr. Covey? And he replied, you know, about 80% of the time.
I love that.
And his point was exactly your point earlier.
Yeah.
I'm trying my best.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really trying to do this, but I slip too. Sometimes I'm reactive rather than proactive. Sometimes I go with the flow rather than begin with the end in mind. And sometimes I don't listen very well.
Yeah.
But I'm always trying. I'm always striving. And that's, again, hopeful that even the guy that wrote this, who believed in it, who really, in my judgment, was a great model of it, also fell short. But he just would constantly get back on track and course correct.
I'm curious, Stephen. I mean, I just full disclosure, I'm not a super religious person. I have a lot of respect for religion and people who have a practice. But I'm curious. I mean, is there a connection between what this book laid out and some of the teachings of his own faith and your faith?
Well, let me broaden the question to say this, that principles belong to all humanity, all humankind, including great enduring religions and faiths, as well as enduring philosophies. And so, because my father has taught, you know, before he passed away, he taught Seven Habits all around the world.
Yep.
But he'd go into different countries with a completely different religious faith or tradition than his. And they might would say, like, he might be in the Middle East, and people might say, this feels like it's straight from the Quran. You know, and it says, well, there's principles that are universal that belong to all enduring faiths. And then he'd go to India, you know, this is Hindu philosophy. And then he'd go to China, this is Confucianism. Well, there's principles that are enduring to all traditions and philosophies that have endured and stood the test of time. But, he, you know, yes, he could find it in his own faith, but he also could find it in other people's faith because the principle is what is universal, whether one has a faith or not. Can I share one more thing of why I think this is timely and relevant today?
Please.
And this is kind of back to what you had said at the outset that this is basic. These are, you know, these are foundational principles. In fact, the original title for the book was going to be the seven basic habits of highly effective people. But the publisher felt like the title was way too long already. So the basic got cut out. And, you know, my point my father was making was these are just foundational things that are so important that we sometimes assume or take for granted. We got to come back. The basic. This is blocking and tackling, right? This is the foundational basics. They're profound and they're actionable.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, when you and we should mention you went on to kind of really operate and run the business, and then went off and founded your own, and you have written several influential books on your own, and are called on to consult and to help leaders and managers, many of whom listen to this show. When somebody calls you, right, and says, "Stephen, I need your help. I'm, you know, in a bind. I just our business is not doing well, and I don't know what's going on. And come and help out." And I'm assuming you get those calls, right?
Yes.
Give me a scenario that you've experienced where that has happened, and what happened, and what did they want help with?
Well, I find for me, because my work, my work is all around trust, and my book is it's best known as called The Speed of Trust, and I'm really standing on the shoulders of my father in doing this, because he tees up the idea of trust in the Seven Habits. You know, he calls it the emotional bank account, the balance of trust in a given relationship, and I kind of just drill down deep on this. And my basic premise is that there's economics to trust. There's a speed to trust. When trust goes up in relationships on teams, you can do everything faster and at less cost. That's a dividend. It's a multiplier. When there's low trust in relationships on teams and companies, you pay a tax at every gate. And so you can quantify trust. And that's kind of a big idea, that trust is not just social, it's financial. So what happens is I'll have people call up and say, you know, where we're at today, we've grown a lot, and we used to have a smaller company, and now it's getting bigger and bigger, and we're losing the sense of culture. We're losing the sense of kind of who we are, and we're bringing in new people. And how do we maintain and even enhance the culture that we had when we were small? That's kind of one area they might bring me in. Another area could be that they've lost trust in the marketplace, or they lost trust with customers. What can we do to rebuild, to restore that trust? And in any and all of those scenarios, you know, my point, I try to come in and help them understand why trust is the one thing that changes everything and will impact everything else they're trying to do. And secondly, how they can build trust on purpose, intentionally, through their credibility and through their behavior. And it's really kind of a drill down dive onto principles my father taught in Seven Habits, because he's teaching about, you know, how the private victory precedes the public victory. And I teach how self-trust precedes relationship trust, which precedes team trust, which precedes organizational trust. But I'm really building on the foundation that my father laid out with these Seven Habits and the basic foundational work of, you know, personal leadership.
Yeah.
Of, you know, going from dependence to independence to interdependence. And then once you achieve that, now I can dive deep into building high trust teams, high trust cultures. But it's hard to do that if people are dependent and not independent.
Yeah. You know, I wonder this book and these principles, and the principles upon, you know, the sort of the foundation upon which you built additional principles and ideas, they're available to anyone. I mean, anybody can get this book and read the Seven Habits, right?
Right.
But what is, you know, when you meet leaders, and many leaders sought your father out and seek you out, what is sort of a common trend that you find that leaders do not do that is kind of an easy thing for them to do?
I think that this will be particularly true with entrepreneurs, but also even leaders in established organizations. It's very easy to kind of, you know, you got where you're at because of your strengths, your competence, your abilities, and that has gotten you to where you're at. But, you know, to move to the next level, to transform your team, to transform your business, you're going to now need to do things differently. And you're going to need to empower people. You're going to need to extend trust to people. You're going to need to engage people. And there's too many entrepreneurs that are still kind of tapped out with how far they can go because they can't leverage and recreate themselves through others. And so the real gift, the real opportunity is to be able to extend this trust, to empower, to see the potential and the capability in other people and to bring it out in them. So let me give you my father's definition for leadership. Yeah. It kind of frames what I'm saying here and what leaders can do today to lead. And here's what my father said leadership is. Leadership is communicating people's worth and potential so clearly that they're inspired to see it in themselves.
Mm.
You bring the leader out in them. You're empowering of them. And then they respond to that. And they rise to the occasion. And they perform better. They're inspired by it. And they give it, the trust back to you. You trust them. They tend to trust you.
I totally agree. So I ask people who come on the show this question, or I ask you this same question. I think your answer is going to be particularly valuable. Are leaders born or are they made? Do you become a leader?
Yes. Some of both, but I'm going to be more in the camp that leaders are made. And I will acknowledge that sometimes there are some people that just seems to have a knack. And you might say that person's a born leader. But I like how Peter Drucker put it about effectiveness. He said, effectiveness cannot be taught, but because it's a discipline, it can be learned. And I would say the same for leadership. It's not so much that we teach leadership per se, but I think we can learn leadership. So leadership is not necessarily taught, but because it's a discipline, leadership can be learned. And I do believe in that sense, leaders are made. I'm also acknowledging that there's certain elements where there might be some naturally gifted people. But I also still think that even there, to become self-aware of the principles behind maybe what makes them a natural leader, to become aware of that helps them go to another level, an even higher level of it too. So I'm more on the side of leaders are made, that we can learn leadership.
I love it. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your self-awareness. And I also, as a father myself with two kids, I really admire your connection to your dad, and the legacy that you and presumably, your siblings have really, maintained and continued.
Yeah, thank you. No, I'll say this about my father. For those that are Seven Habits fans or readers or have been impacted by it, that, as you mentioned, my father passed away about in 2012. Mm. And I said this at his funeral, and I'll say it here now. As good as my father was in public, as a speaker, as an author, and he was very, very good. As good as he was in public, he was even better in private.
Huh.
Some people can give a very powerful presentation on stage, and then they walk off stage, they're like a different person in how they treat others. Well, my father was really good on stage, and he was even better off stage.
Stephen M.R. Covey is currently CEO of the boutique management consulting firm Covey Link Worldwide, which he co-founded with Greg Link. Stephen's co-author on the national bestseller Smart Trust, Creating Prosperity, Energy, and Joy in a Low-Trust World. Stephen joined me from his home in Provo, Utah. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary and Built It Productions.